When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
Had enough of those supplements that leave you feeling nothing? Symbionica is your solution to great-tasting, all-natural supplements that actually work. Crafted with premium plant-based ingredients, their products have no seed oils, fillers, or toxins. Try them out and actually feel the difference today. Visit Symbionica.com and use code IHEART for 15% off plus free shipping on your subscription order. Again, that's 15% off plus free shipping on your subscription order. Go to Symbionica.com. C-Y-M-B-I-O. T-I-K-A.com.
You know that feeling when you walk into your home, take a deep breath, and feel new? Well, that's what it's like to use Clorox Scentiva. Because Clorox Scentiva smells like coconut, cleans like Clorox, and feels like energy. It'll elevate any cleaning routine to not just clean, but also make every room smell like a tropical coconut getaway. Discover how Clorox Scentiva's powerful clean and refreshing scents can transform your space. Get yours in coconut or other fabulous scents at a nearby retail store.
Things like 9/11 or wars or pandemics or recessions. And that certainly has some influence on people, but not as much as technology and technological change.
Hello, and welcome to the Psychology Podcast. Today we welcome Gene Twenge to the podcast. Gene is professor of psychology at San Diego State University. She frequently gives talks and seminars on generational differences in technology based on a data set of 39 million people. Her audiences have included college faculty and staff, parent groups, military personnel, camp directors, and corporate executives. Her work has been repeatedly featured by the media, and she has authored more than 180 scientific publications and books, including iGen, Generation Me, and the Narcissism Epidemic. Her latest book, which is her magnum opus, is called Generations. In this episode, I talked to Gene Twenge about the real differences between the generations. Did you know that our current time has the most number of living generations to coexist ever in the history of humanity? Unfortunately, there is often conflict and miscommunication between them. According to Gene, this is largely due to how the advancement of tech has shaped major life experiences. She shares interesting statistics about each cohort and debunks common misconceptions about baby boomers, millennials, Gen Z, and others. We also touch on the topics of narcissism, polarization, mental health, gender identity, and compassion. So without further ado, I bring you Gene Twenge.
Nice to finally meet you.
Yeah, I feel the same.
It's been a while, but it's good timing because this is your magnum opus.
Yes, it is. Absolutely.
Wow. Wow. Generations, the real differences between Gen Z, millennials, Gen X, boomers, and silence, and what they mean for America's future. No big deal. No big deal. Wow. I mean, talk about a synthesis of data. You know, we talk about, like, you know, in grad school, it's like if I have more than 200 participants, I'm happy. I get a PhD. But your analysis is derived from 21 data sets that go back to the 1940s and up to as recent as this year, spanning about 38 million people. Is that right?
That's about right. Yeah. And I'm fortunate I did not have to collect that data myself.
Yeah. Yeah. That is good. That is good. Your book covers these five generations: silence, born 1925, 1945, boomers, born 1946, 1964, Generation X, which we'll talk about because I don't even know where I belong, but that's born 1965 to 1979, millennials, born 1980 to 1994, and Gen Z, born 1995 to 2012. What is the main criteria upon which those five were clustered?
You mean in terms of determining, say, the birth year cutoffs, that type
yes.
of thing?
Yeah. Who decided that?
Yeah. Well, nobody and everybody. There's not really any commission that decides, you know, what those cutoffs should be. You know, pretty much everybody agrees that living now is different from what it was like to live 100 years ago or 50 years ago or even 20 years ago. And we agree that that has an effect on, you know, people's behaviors and attitudes and values. So really, you know, the debate is kind of around the details of then, you know, how do you group the generations? Are those cutoffs the right ones? So for boomers, it was fairly clear based on demographics, based on the baby boom, so on fertility rates. And then from there, it's a little bit more fuzzy, but technology has accelerated, you know, some of the turnover and change. And so the generations have got a little bit shorter. And the cutoffs that I'm using are, you know, more or less agreed upon, although you can certainly debate them.
Okay. Yeah, I've seen Gen X sometimes defined. Sometimes I see like the missing year 1979, which is the year I was born, and some people don't know where to put that.
Yeah. I think most of the theories and most of the cutoffs would put you as a Gen Xer. So you're okay. A late Gen Xer, right, in that transition between Gen X and millennials.
I'm an early millennial.
I haven't seen a whole lot of people using 79 for early millennial. It usually the cutoffs either 1980 for the first year for millennials, or sometimes I see 1981, sometimes I see 1982.
Okay. Well, you know, the traditional or classic way of kind of talking about the thing that kind of is the main differentiator between all these things is looking at major life events that everyone experienced together. But you argue in your book that that's maybe missing out on some really key differences between these things. Is that right?
Yeah, I think so. Because, yeah, that's the traditional focus was on major events. You know, how old were you when certain big things happened in the world or in the country? So things like 9/11 or wars or pandemics or recessions. And that certainly has some influence on people, but not as much as technology and technological change. And there, I'm not just talking about computers and smartphones, but also things like labor-saving devices like washing machines, air conditioning, airplanes, better medical care. You know, these are the things that make living now so completely different from what it was like to live in a previous era.
You know, what was it like being a silent, the silence generation during the Great Depression? Obviously, there was no TV, right? And no phones, very hard to communicate. I guess you wrote letters to each other a lot, right? You know,
yeah.
Kind of remnants from the 1800s. You know?
Yeah. You could talk on the phone, but, you know, you had to pay the big bill if it was long distance. Gen Xers are kind of the last generation to really remember that, although probably maybe some millennials too.
Well, let's start with the silent generation a little bit and talk about them. There's some interesting research suggesting they may have been more mentally healthy than the generations before them. And also after them? Is that true? Like out of all the generations, they might be more most, and they had the least technology. So, what's going on there?
Yeah.
Is there a causation there? No.
Maybe. You know, I think there's the silent generation does show some a little bit more of the influence of big events, probably because there were huge events when they were young, like the Great Depression and like World War II. And a lot fewer of them were drafted. Mm-hmm. So a lot of silence fought in Korea, but a lot fewer than, say, the greatest generation before them fighting in World War II. And then less than boomers being drafted to Vietnam. So they kind of had that sweet spot. They, you know, were really coming to adulthood during that post-war prosperity. Mm-hmm. And that seems to have kind of grounded them and maybe helped them develop, you know, a more positive outlook on life.
How do you know what their mental health was? What's the data you're looking at there that you could possibly compare to this generation, for instance?
Yeah, so you're always with these things of looking at generational differences and change over time. You're a little bit of a prisoner to the data that's out there.
Sure.
There is a big survey that has asked about how many days people have of poor mental health in a month. Kind of a crude measure, but it goes back to 1993. And then we can kind of control for age and look at each generation. And so that's one of the data sets I used for that conclusion or silence. You control for age and then take a look. Their mental health is better than the greatest generation before them and the boomers after them.
You said something really interesting there about controlling for age. I am an individual differences researcher. So my natural question is, is the variation within each generation greater than the variation between?
I mean, for most group differences, you're going to have more variation.
Like sex differences, within. For instance.
Yeah, right, so absolutely. Much, yeah. And the same is true for generations.
You know, I'm just wondering how much of these effects are related to age. But I'm glad that you said you controlled for age. That's that.
Oh yeah. Like, I mean,
that's kind of the obvious thing.
Oh yeah, yeah, you have to. You gotta consider that.
I
know.
I agree. Well, I'm glad you said that. You know, I think another kind of obvious, maybe obvious question a lot of people are thinking is it normal for every generation to criticize or be confused by the generation that follows? Is that just like the pattern you find over and over again?
I think it is kind of human nature. As things change around you, you're trying to figure it out. So I think each generation, as they get older, then is trying to figure out how the world changed almost kind of underneath them. And then also trying to understand the young generation. I've always found it fascinating that older generations are really fascinated by younger ones. Younger ones, not so much about older generations. They're like, oh, you guys are done. And it's just, they want to kind of skip over it or something. You guys are done.
No, there is that kind of attitude.
I mean, they're not going to actually say that, but that's kind of what the motivation seems to be sometimes. And I don't know. I think it's always better if we're trying to all understand each other. That's usually the better outcome.
I agree. But, you know, there's just this spirit in the air. It just doesn't feel loving. Between the generations. Mm-hmm. I don't like the way it makes me feel. Mm-hmm. You know, like okay boomer, you know, are you familiar with that insult?
Yeah.
You know,
or... And I'm completely with you. I mean, it's really, really unfortunate. And I think there's a lot of generational misunderstanding and conflict now. I think some of it just comes from that we communicate in different ways. And that technological change has kind of sped up those differences and led to some of those misunderstandings. And, you know, to be fair, it's not just across generations. We have a lot of political polarization. Like, you know, we have a lot of negativity just overall.
Okay. I really want to understand this. I agree there's a lot of political polarization. I looking at all the differences between, and there's a lot, it's a rich book. It is your magnum opus. Seriously, congratulations. What I find so fascinating is there's something really, really different about this, about what's the latest generation, Gen Z, is that there's something like it's almost like at least the other four generations, they're talking the same language. Like, yeah, maybe drugs, but there's more drugs in one than the other, but everyone knows what drugs are. Yeah, but there's something, you know, in Gen Z, it's like, you can call it the transgender generation, you know, just looking at your stats, I'm like, why not call it the transgender generation or the gender fluid generation? Because that is what it's just there's something very, very different about Generation Z. I'm not making any judgment call about it, but I'm just stating, you know, what stood out to me when I was looking at reading all the difference between all the generations. And to what extent is so much this political polarization being driven by Gen Z? I guess that's my question. Yeah.
I think politically, the break is between Gen X and millennials. Which is kind of fascinating because in a lot of psychological ways around individualism, self-focus, things like that, those two generations are actually kind of similar in how they grew up and some of their attitudes. But politically, that's where the break occurs. Whether we're talking about, you know, Democrats versus Republicans, conservative versus liberal, that type of politics, or just things in the culture in general around free speech, around, you know, how much we should be talking about things versus not, about, you know, just all of these campus controversies and so on. That's where the break seems to take place.
Well, that's interesting that you put it there because, you know, like Coddling the American Mind kind of book, they put it at really at this generation. They put it in the last like 10 years.
Oh, yeah. You know, and it has definitely accelerated for sure.
Okay, so it's accelerated.
And I don't disagree with that idea that, you know, Gen Z has taken that next level. But I think there's a lot of millennial participation in some of those things. I think on campus, it was Gen Z that really kind of brought those issues to the forefront. But in the last 5 years or so, when there's been conflicts around free speech or political things in the workplace, it's often been millennials and Gen Z banding together versus the Gen X and boomer managers or bosses.
Yeah. I want to talk about that later. I have that on my list to talk about. I really want to talk about narcissism because, you know, this is I've wanted every new book you have that comes out. You know, I was like, oh, I really want to have her on my podcast. So this is finally I get you on my podcast and we get to like go back in the archives of your work, which is great. And the narcissism research, I love how it's evolved. I've seen an evolution with you, you know, and qualifications emerge. Mm-hmm. So I'm almost glad I waited. I am glad I waited till now because, you know, this is, we get the most up to date information. My reading of the situation is that Generation X is kind of like the self-esteem movement generation, not necessarily narcissism, but it's like self-esteem is the gateway drug to narcissism. Mm-hmm. this is just my
at least
my,
when it's not based on anything real,
right.
It is
nothing real. It's like you're strong enough, you're good enough, you know, like those the Saturday Night Live skit.
Yep, Stuart Smalley.
And then that I feel like was a gateway drug to the millennials, like just up to 2008, a sort of full blown, not just like I'm good enough, doggone it, but I'm the best.
Right.
Yeah.
And then that all fell apart.
Yes. So tell me what happened after. I know. And I think that's, I've been following your work. So after 2008, it fell apart and then it started, it seems like it started to kind of like drastically go down in terms of mental health, in terms of, it's almost like some bubble popped, some self-illusion or something. It's like, oh my gosh, you know, like, the way I see it is now we live in a very victimhood mentality based culture. Mm-hmm. But that's just my perception. What are your thoughts on this? Do you agree?
Yeah. No, I think the change in narcissism is one of the few examples of psychological traits where you really see the impact of the Great Recession. A recession. A lot of other things don't really change all that much around economic cycles, but narcissism really did. It peaked right before the Great Recession and then started to go down. But then, you know, there's got to be something else going on because the U.S. economy then started to improve after 2011 or 2012, right? But narcissism kept going down. But that coincides with some of the other trends with the transition to Gen Z of the rise in depression, the rise in unhappiness, the decline in self-esteem, you know, all of which would, at least for a young population, point in that same direction of narcissism also going down.
I've wanted to bring something up with you for a long time. I guess it's the common theme of our conversation today, but I'm glad I want to bring this to see what your thoughts on this are, if you've thought of this in this way. I've been differentiating in my research quite a bit between grandiose narcissism and vulnerable narcissism. And what I'm seeing in my data is actually an increase in vulnerable narcissism.
Makes sense. Interesting.
Yeah. And I'm wondering how that lands for you.
Yeah. I think that makes a lot of sense. I mean, of course, you know, as you know full well, the tough part is the NPI really measures grandiose. And that's been, you know, the most common.
That's a huge problem. That's right. That's why we have to create new scales. Yeah.
Exactly. And then you probably don't have the data going back in time. So, you know, I can see how that's, you know, it's challenging to nail down, you know, some of the evidence on that, but I think that makes perfect sense given the other trends with self-esteem going down, depression going up, and so on. And I'm curious, you know, are you using that also to explain some of the things around, like you said, the culture of victimhood? Is that
100%.
How you're framing
it? That's really where all my research is going right now. Yeah, I've kind of put all hands on deck on that topic because I think it's a really urgent issue. And I'm going to link it to the mental health crisis. But yes, so not to turn the interview around on me, but
no, I love
this
it.
Is a mutual inquiry and curiosity. Yeah. What I find really interesting is the construct of vulnerable narcissism is a mess. And I have argued the best definition of it is just simply entitlement that is based on perceived fragility or past history of suffering.
Fascinating.
Yeah, because that way you can directly compare that to grandiose narcissism defined as entitlement grounded in perceived inherent superiority. Mm-hmm. And therefore you can see the contrast. Whereas some people have a lot of, they're like, neuroticism is the distinguisher between, the problem is you start bringing all these other things. You're not, you know, neuroticism doesn't get the entitlement part, you know?
No.
So I feel the entitlement is what's core to narcissism. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of like tangential aspects or facets that are discussed. So when you look at it that way, yes, absolutely. I've cheekily thought maybe I should just call this generation the fragility generation or the fragile generation. But there is a sort of sort of entitlement based on, you know, on a fragility, a perceived fragility that one has, that they can't handle the world. Yeah.
And it's, I've struggled with this a lot too, because, you know, people have used the label snowflakes,
right?
And talked right. about fragility. And I struggle with it so much because, although, you know, there's a grain of truth to that, on the other hand, we're talking about a generation where their rates of depression doubled within an 8-year period.
Yeah.
You know, these are really serious mental health issues, and I don't want them dismissed. And
I agree.
You know what I mean? And I don't,
I do.
I'm kind of uncomfortable with the idea of, you know, anything that's trying to blame or to criticize based on true mental health issues, if that makes any sense.
It makes a profound sense. And I personally like to stay away from the, you know, coddling language, you know.
Yeah,
it doesn't feel as compassionate as it could be. I raised that in a discussion I had with Greg and John at the Comedy Cellar in New York City.
Of all places.
Yeah. But striking that balance, I find really difficult between saying things that you're feeding into a delusion. Like, I think sometimes the highest form of kindness is not feeding into someone's delusion.
Yeah, true.
And so how do we hold that up, you know, as a truth, while also holding up the fact that it must really suck, show a little compassion and perspective taking.
What they're feeling
is painful.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
You know, how do you hold both up at the same time and hold space for both?
Right. Yeah. Right. That's exactly the challenge. Because, I mean, you think about Gen Z and their childhood and adolescence and what they've had to face, you know, not spending as much time with their friends face to face, it being almost mandatory to be on social media and to have all of those pressures. You know, that's the only world that they've known. And then it's not a wonder, you know, that so many of them are depressed. But then, you know, does that mean we should just accept the idea that free speech is dead? I hope not.
Yeah, I hope not as well. I guess when I look at the full pattern of data among Gen Z, I try to understand which ones are linked to which. Mm-hmm. So for instance, this statistic is fascinating. Nearly a third of men ages 18 to 25 did not have sex in the last year. Now, I knew that Gen Zers were having less sex, but I actually, until I read your book, did not realize that the effect was larger for men. Mm-hmm. Within that age range. I did not know that. Mm-hmm. But I did know that there's called a loneliness epidemic. I guess I'm aware of using the word epidemic, but among young men, there really is really sky high levels of loneliness. And so I guess I don't know how all these things are linked. If all the women are becoming men, I'm just saying, like, take the imagination of how these things could be linked. You know, if now all the young girls now are becoming transgender or non-binary, you know, like, no one wants the men, no one wants the biological men anymore.
I don't think that's what's going on, though.
Okay, then tell me what's going on.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's always a little speculative when you're trying to get to the causes, but for the changes in sexual activity, I think some of it is more depressed. So in depression, when people are depressed,
men are more depressed.
Why are they more depressed?
Yeah. Why do you think?
I mean, I think it's for a lot of the same reasons that young women are depressed, is because the way that they socialize has changed in a way that's not good for mental health.
Mm.
So I think that's at the core of a lot of it. So that piece is in there. Some of it is they're just taking longer to grow up. So that, you know, as you know, is another big theme in Generations about the slow life strategy, which has its advantages and disadvantages. Mm. But there are just more young men and women who at 20 or 21, when in previous generations they would have been sexually active, are putting that off until later in their lives. And that might not be entirely a bad thing.
I didn't find the statistic on young women ages 18 to 25. Are they having more sex than prior generations?
It's also less. It's just not as big of a shift.
I see. Okay. Yeah. I was looking for that statistic. Okay, got it. But there's a lot more gender fluidity. Do you think that, I mean, it's so controversial when when people propose the sort of social contagion hypothesis, transgender activists immediately tear that down and say that's transphobia. So I don't, I'm asking what the data suggests. Do you think it's because is there some cultural influences there, or and or could it be that prior generations there would have been those rates if it was as acceptable to be transgender in prior generations?
Yeah, I mean, that's what makes it so fascinating. We don't really know. So I think it's definitely true that if you look at, say, the rise in individualism, more focus on the self, less on social roles, that more acceptance of people being transgender or non-binary is a very logical outcome of that, you know, cultural system. And I think that's just been growing over time. But that is the question of how much of it is due to greater acceptance. And that's the theory that most people go on. But, you know, you dig into it and you have to answer a couple of questions that I'm just not sure of the answers yet. Like, if it's just greater acceptance, if that's really the primary driver, then why is it that identifying as transgender hasn't changed hardly at all among people who are age 30 and older? Because it hasn't. It's really only been young adults where you see that huge increase, the quadrupling of those, you know, identifying as trans. It hasn't really happened with older people. But it's certainly possible that maybe among older people, it's just their lives are more settled and it would be a much bigger disruption for them to come out as trans.
Bring that down as a way to table that for my own brain, because I want to reflect on that. That is such a good point. Yeah, I guess we just don't know. We do know that there is a, you know, we know culturally there's a shift in among peers, and it depends how you want to frame it. You know, you can frame it as acceptance, frame it as like, I don't know if there's peer pressure, you know, ever to sort of feel like, you know, let's say you're a, you know, having identity crisis is nothing new to teenagers in any generation. I'm sure a lot of silent teenagers had identity crises, and, you know, wanting to belong, wanting to fit in, wanting to be part of, you know, a group or, you know, get special privileges. You know, I don't know exactly, because I'm obviously not immersed in school culture right now, you know? So I guess you just have to really look at that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I've heard that argument and I understand the idea of like, oh, maybe people want to fit in and find a group and so on. On the other hand, think about what trans kids and teens have to put up with and the amount of bullying they have to put up with.
Yeah, it's just like, why right? would they
and
choose
then
that?
You think about it that way, it's like, I don't know. That it doesn't sound as likely.
I hear you about transgender, but I'm talking about an overall global pattern of gender fluidity. In terms of, like, you know, saying like you're non-binary. Non-binary seems to be a really profoundly new category than the prior generations, you know? You know, I don't know. I could see someone who's having a real serious identity crisis sort of feeling such pressure to like cling to an identity, male or female, that they don't feel a resonance with. Mm-hmm. I can see how the non-binary gender can be very relaxing. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
I could see it.
Yeah. And I think that's just been made possible by the all of the shifts, you know, that have happened culturally around equality and gender and freedom and individualism.
Yeah. Oh my God, so much data here. Well, okay, why don't you tell me some of the most surprising facts in terms of some myths of generational differences that you came across? You're like, wow, that myth really needs to be debunked. Can you debunk some myths for me, please?
I'll try. So, you know, I think there's this really common perception that boomers are all really economically successful, and that income inequality was something that they really started, and that, you know, boomers became successful and then climbed up the ladder and pulled it up after they had climbed it, so the millennials, you know, couldn't be successful. And it turns out that whole narrative just falls apart, you know, very, very quickly when you start looking at the data. So first, sure, a lot of boomers have done well for themselves, but there's a big segment, especially those who did not go to college, where the economy changed underneath them and they found themselves in a pretty difficult situation. And that's why you get things like a lot more depression, especially among those who are lower income and have less education among boomers. And then the findings of Case and Deaton, the famous findings of the mortality rate among middle-aged Americans starting to go up, especially those who are white and not college educated. And that's driven by boomers. So you can see the despair in certain segments of that generation because they are not the kings of the world that they're, you know, are sometimes perceived to be as boomers. They're very much on the other side of that and, you know, with these challenges. And then on the flip side of that is the idea about millennials struggling, that very, very common narrative everywhere online about millennials, that they not do as well as their parents, they have to have side gigs, they'll never own houses. Well, median incomes among 26 to 39-year-olds are at all-time highs, corrected for inflation. Homeownership rates virtually identical for millennials, Gen Xers, and boomers. It's not all completely rosy. A lot of those income gains have been driven by women, which sounds like a good thing, but then that means, say, a heterosexual couple wants to have kids, then they have to pay for daycare. So there's definitely challenges in there, but that core idea that millennials are not economically successful is exactly wrong.
Okay, well, that's good to dispel. The idea of this New York Times headline I saw, 37-year-olds are afraid of the 23-year-olds who work for them.
Yeah, good headline.
Oh my gosh. Mm-hmm. Not talking about that many years different, you know, in the whole scheme of the universe. And yet there seems to be such a gulf, you know,
between that's millennials who are now the adults in the room. Now and they're still trying to get used to that, just like Gen Xers had to get used to it and still kind of aren't.
They're trying
and
to
then
figure out
Gen Z.
They're trying to figure out Gen Z. I see this in the university setting with millennial and older trying to understand the Gen Zers, trying to understand what are the kids. Now, there are some people who really think, probably Jonathan Haidt and Greg Luganoff would probably think that they're giving in too much. They're sort of like one model of thinking about this, almost like a fight. Or a competition, you know, of like, you know, do we give in to the Gen Z demands, you know, the crazy demands? Mm-hmm. But then there's certainly another view of a lot of professors who are like, wow, there's so much wisdom here in the Gen Zers, and I've seen the whole gamut as a professor, you know, across and on my faculty meetings, you know, at the faculty meetings, they're divided, but I'm just laying out different perspectives and conceptualizations. A lot of my friends at Barnard College at Columbia, you know, really see a lot of are like, yeah, go Gen Zers. They're really shaking things up in a way that needs to be shaken up. They're not like, oh, we're coddling them, you know. So I see different perspectives on the table. And so it's almost as if, like, you know, even taking the Gen Zers out of the equation, like the other generations don't really agree. Not everyone agrees with each other on how they should treat the Gen Zers or how they should view them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, you know, the last 5 or 6 years I've given a lot of talks on generational differences. And of course, being a faculty member, one of the most common audiences is my fellow faculty members on various campuses. Yeah. And this is the essential tension. I think it's been true for decades.
The essential tension. I feel it. I feel it,
you know,
on campus.
It is, because you have to figure out how much are you going to change your teaching and how you're presenting things for this generation. Yeah. But then if you completely change it, to be a little extreme about it, and if you give the students exactly what they want, it'd be maybe in some cases anyway, an A for no work. Maybe we don't want to do that. You know, we have to figure out what's good for them in the long term. But that doesn't mean we should be sticks in the mud and not change at all. So there's that balance, like how much are we going to change in our teaching? And then how much are we not going to change? Because we still have to prepare students for the workplace and grad school, and that we can't, you know, give in too much. But, you know, that is what was one of my goals, certainly, in writing this book, is to start with that piece of understanding of, yes, we have things in common, but here are some of the differences, and then maybe helps you know a little bit more what your students experienced before they reached your classroom.
Oh, I love your compassion, and I really like the way you think. I do. I realize that when I say things like, I think that this is the generation of vulnerable narcissism, even though I think it's true, I realize that obviously calling people narcissists is not a flattering, really, you know, kind way of treating a human. But if we can more finely differentiate what really counts technically as entitlement, because I think that we do see some real vulnerable narcissism, and what isn't entitlement, but what isn't really entitlement, but are adults kind of saying, oh, that's entitled kids, you know, but actually the kids have a good point.
Yeah.
Sorting out those, that's the nuance that I like, you know, and I feel like I get the sense you do too, but you know what I'm saying? Like,
yeah, no, completely. Yeah. I mean, I think that plays out in the classroom. It plays out in the workplace. I think it's really something to watch in the political arena as well. Because where's the line between, you know, oh, these kids are so entitled, or I disagree with them because they're across the political spectrum for me, right? Mm-hmm. So like if you're a Republican and you see young people saying we need universal health care, oh, that's an entitlement. How entitled is that, right? But then a Democrat might think, no, this is good. They're fighting for the change that they want, and they believe in this. So, you know, it is really classic social psychology, isn't it? That how you view it depends on your own attitude.
Absolutely. I personally, teaching as a professor across generations, have noticed a shift in this sense. I noticed that a lot of students expect now, in a way they never did before, that if they say that a certain material is too hard or it's like difficult, making them uncomfortable having to do the homework, therefore I should be like, oh, no problem, here's your extension.
Right.
And to me, there is a little bit of entitlement there, you know, and I try so hard to be compassionate. I mean, especially when I was like, oh my God, my parents passed away, but you know, give me an excuse. But what I'm seeing now sometimes are no excuses other than like, I had an assignment once where I'm like, just think of one question a week on the readings that you did. And I literally would have some students be like, Professor Kaufman, that's an unreasonable request. I can't think of any questions to ask. And I'm like, you're at an Ivy League school and you can't come up with one question. I'm sorry, but like,
right.
No,
yeah.
That's not okay. Yeah,
right.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's just such a huge challenge, you know, being a faculty member, that you want to be fair to all your students.
Yeah.
But then there are sometimes these extenuating circumstances, and where do you draw that? Where do you draw that line? And then, you know, COVID was a whole other, you know, wrench in that, because then, you know, we just had to be more flexible just the way it was. And so now we're like, well, now do we have to roll that back? And right. I don't know. My basic philosophy is as much compassion as possible in the classroom to be able to have an open discussion.
Yeah.
But then, you know, when it comes to actually getting that work done, you have to be a little bit more of a hard ass, honestly. Yeah.
I mean, if you're at your university, like certain base expectations, base at most base level. Is it true that this is the most number of living generations alive at the same time than ever in human history?
Yeah. Because technology's changed so much, the generations have gotten shorter. Now, you know, as we discussed, so it's somewhat arbitrary, but I think you can certainly make a case for the cultural change of the last 20 to 30 years being pretty considerable. And so that's why we have the shorter generations. And that's why we have 6 living American generations right now.
That's incredible. That's incredible. And I also didn't know that Biden is the first ever silent generation president.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yeah.
I mean, how's he in touch with anyone? I guess some would argue he's not, you know, in some political sides, but that's incredible.
And I mean, in general, our political leaders are older now than they were a generation.
They're getting older and older.
Yes.
getting like every new president's now, like our next president could be 105 years old.
Right. Well, this is a debate, right? You know, is that good? Because with age comes wisdom, or is it that they're out of touch? And, you know, that's going to vary depending on the individual and so on. But, you know, as a Gen Xer, I can tell you there was, you know, when I made the graph showing that boomers really were blocking the way of Gen X into political leadership. Yep. That's when it was a little hard for me to keep my opinion out of it. I tried as much as I possibly can to keep my opinion out of it. But with that, I was like, yep, I knew it. There was definitely some boomer blockage of Gen Xers, and partially just because they're a bigger generation, but that doesn't explain all of it. Even if you take that into account, in both politics and in business, boomers are hanging on to their leadership positions longer than previous generations, and then Gen X isn't able to move up. Although there's some speculation Gen X may not want to move up because they're just not into that as much.
So interesting. Politically, why does it feel like the right, like conservatives, like get triggered by Gen Zers?
Because
do you see how I turned that around? Do you see how I turned that around? Do you see how I flipped the trigger thing? But it feels like they get really triggered by Gen Zers.
Yeah, I mean, that is one way you could use that verb. Well, conservatism by definition means you want things to stay the same. It's opposed to progressivism, where you want things to change. And generally, you know, there are generational differences, you know, based on when you're born, that push people, you know, more toward Democrat or liberal and Republican or conservative. But there is the general principle that people become more conservative as they get older, partially because it's like, okay, that's enough change. You know, we can stop now. I stop the world. I want to get off. And then young people say, no, you know, we want more change. And so that's I think why there's that generational tension, particularly with older conservatives. Older progressives are often like, no, I love the kids.
Yes. No, well, that's right. And so you see that split on the faculty as well. Yeah. So my question is then, Generation X had the consistently most Republican generation. So were the boomers like triggered by Generation X, I guess is my question, in a parallel argument?
Boomers have such an odd political trajectory. They started as very liberal and then switched to be conservative, and seemingly almost overnight, although it was, you know, a linear change that took a few decades to really roll out. But it's almost like with Reagan in the 80s, something clicked and their general tendency switched away from being progressive to being more conservative.
Yeah, that's so interesting. And then the silent generation, the leaders of the civil rights movement, feminist movement, early gay rights movement, were actually silenced, not the boomers.
That's right.
So why don't the silenced get the credit that they deserve for making progress, social progress?
Yeah. I think they just didn't make as much noise as the boomers, partially because of their generational size and partially just because of their kind of generational personality. They're such a fascinating generation because many of them married young, had their kids young. You know, they were the young people of the 50s and early 60s, where that was kind of the old post-war set of values and ways, you know, of living your life. Yet at the edges, they were the activists. They were the ones who got the laws changed. So Martin Luther King Jr., Ruth Bader Ginsburg, both silenced, you know, and most of the leaders of the civil rights movement, the feminist movement, and the gay rights movement as well, those were mostly silenced. So the way I ended up parsing it in the book is that the silence, for the most part, changed the laws. And then the boomers changed hearts and minds because they actually lived the changes that the silence started in terms of race and gender and sexual orientation.
I like that. We have not really talked at all about the greatest generation or the alpha generation. These are two that I want to add to it. Maybe your next book will somehow add those two. Let's first start with the greatest generation, which is the one before the silent generation, often because the greatest because it's thought they've suffered the most or they've kind of been through the most epic, most downtrodden events. But could one make the case that with COVID and with that maybe Gen Z is the new great generation?
Well, I mean, that kind of goes back to the idea that generations come in cycles, which I don't think is true based on the data that we have. And I think pandemics are different from wars. Wars tend to bring people together to fight against a common enemy. And the pandemic drove us apart, if anything. I mean, it could have been that model of we're going to band together, but that's not how it turned out. And that it's kind of the nature of pandemics too. Everybody is the enemy, you know, because it's contagious for one thing. And then the stakes are so high in terms of the political decisions that not everybody's going to be happy. So that's how it ended up. And so I think those are two pretty different events. Plus, you know, my main thesis in the book is that those events are not going to have as big of an impact as the changes in technology.
Yeah. The change of technology are obviously going to even, you know, going on in the next 100 years. It'll be so interesting to see what happens there. So then let's talk about, yeah, the alpha generation and beyond. How do you see the rise of AI as maybe affecting generational differences, especially when we get to, I don't think we're that far away from cyborg territory. You know, are we going to have the cyborg generation someday, do you think?
I don't know. And I think, you know, that's the stuff with, you know, chat GPT and so on that didn't even enter the scene until I turned in the book. So I hadn't had the chance to really consider, you know, how that might change the, you know, this next very young generation who's still mostly in elementary school. And some haven't even been born yet. So that's born 2013 and later. So I actually call them polars after political polarization and the melting polar ice caps. Alphas is based on the idea that, you know, we're going to do all the letters, and then we had Gen Z, and then we ran out of letters. So it's to go back to the beginning of the alphabet and start to use the Greek alphabet. I'm not a big fan of the letters overall. So I'm hoping eventually we'll move away from them.
Is that where did someone propose alpha? I mean, is that what's on the list for the next one?
Yeah. I mean, that's a lot of marketers when they talk about them, that's the label that they use. So yeah, a couple times in a row now I've tried to say, let's get away from the letters, and I haven't been successful, but I'm going to keep trying.
There is something really profound about the fact that this is the, you know, the longest all five generations have all lived together, and we all faced a really significant catastrophe together. Mm-hmm. So, like, ending this interview, can we be a little bit more like uniting than divisive? Isn't there a great bonding experience that, you know, even that we can all have with each other? I mean, we all went through this. It's not like just the Gen Zers sometimes act as though they're the only ones who went through crap. No, I'm just, sorry. But we all went through this together, you know? What can we do to kind of like all really just show compassion for each other, no matter the age?
I hope we can do that. I think it's very tough though, because the pandemic did really exacerbate the political polarization and the generational conflicts, you know, that were already there. But what I would really, really like to see is just trying to turn more toward more positivity, if possible. Yes. I'm not talking about Pollyanna stuff or, you know, not recognizing that we have problems to solve, but the really pervasive negativity across all generations, maybe in particular Gen Z, but pretty much everybody these days, thinking, you know, we're on the wrong track and we can't solve these problems and this is the worst time ever. Can we have some recognition that this is actually a really great time to be alive? That, yeah, we have challenges, but consider what it would have been like to live 200 years ago or 100 years ago without the conveniences that we have, and try to appreciate technology that's made our lives better while trying to rein in some of the technology that has maybe not made our lives better. And of course, the thing I talk about the most with that is just putting more regulation around social media, especially with kids. And maybe that would help. It'll help. Maybe that'll help with mental health. Maybe that'll help with our politics.
Yes. Now you talk about, you're focusing on technology, but I think from a Steven Pinker Enlightenment Now perspective, he's documented in all the many ways that society has shown progress over the years. You know, multitude of ways,
right?
including gender rights, you know, and racial, you know, reduction
and the overall decline in aggression and violence.
Yeah.
You made that case in the other book, and I mean it's all true. I think it's just so easy to take for granted the good things. I mean, I think that's human nature in a lot of ways, right? But I get a little concerned when I see people saying, "Oh, 2023, that's the worst time." Really? Is that really worse than the beginning of the pandemic? Is it worse than the Great Recession? Is it worse than the 80s when we thought Russia was going to drop the bomb at any moment? I don't think it is.
Well, that's great. I just want to end on that note. I wanted to end on some sort of, you know, uniting note there. And thank you for your incredible, legendary work in our field of psychology. This is the Psychology Podcast, so I have to thank you for your legendary work in the field. I'm glad I finally got a chance to talk to you.
Thanks. Thank you for what you do as well.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Psychology Podcast. If you'd like to react in some way to something you heard, I encourage you to join in the discussion at thepsychologypodcast.com or on our YouTube page, The Psychology Podcast. We also put up some videos of some episodes on our YouTube page as well, so you'll want to check that out. Thanks for being such a great supporter of the show, and tune in next time for more on the mind, brain, behavior, and creativity.
Good sleep should come naturally, and with the new Natural Hybrid mattress, it can. A collaboration between Lisa and West Elm, the Natural Hybrid is expertly crafted from natural latex, natural wool, and certified safe foams to elevate your sleep sanctuary and support a greener tomorrow. Plus, every purchase helps fuel Lisa's work with shelters and those in need. Don't put off a good night's sleep any longer. Get a Lisa mattress today for a sound sleep tonight. Visit lisa.com/iHeart. That's LEESA.com/iHeart.
Imagine getting in a hot, stuffy car in the summer. You know how it cools off much faster when you roll down the windows first to get the hot air out? Well, that's exactly how an Easy Breathe basement ventilation system works, removing all the musty, damp, stagnant air and replacing it with fresher, cleaner, drier air. Take charge of your air with Easy Breathe ventilation and get $250 off today. Ask about DIY kits. Visit takechargeofyourair.com or call 866-822-7328.
Since every minute counts when you're a new parent, who wants to waste time washing bottles? Transform this daily chore with the Baby Brezza Bottle Washer Pro, the first machine that automatically washes, sterilizes, and dries bottles, pump parts, and sippy cups at the push of a button. Its 20 spray jets clean everything 100%. Plus, it sterilizes with steam, then dries with germ-free air. Don't waste time on tedious hand washing. Let the Baby Brezza Bottle Washer Pro do it for you. Shop now at babybrezza.com.